Come to Los Angeles. The sun shines bright, the beaches are wide and inviting, and the coffee is the best you've ever tasted. Well, that last part isn't true if you're one of the many people who've switched to Spark Plug Coffee. You know that the secret to a great cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans, but fresh roasted coffee can be as elusive as an honest cop. So do yourself a favor and shine a light on Spark Plug. Spark Plug starts with only premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this excellent coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. You will taste the difference. Remember, dear readers, you heard it here first. Off the record, on the QT, and very hush-hush. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. And action.
Hey there, boyos, and thanks, Teutons, for checking out the Next 100 Project. If you know us as the AFI people, well, we were. Now we check out random great shit. And we spoil all kinds of shit. I'm the sexy whore cut up to look like the very regular Ryan Ellis. And with me on the couch is that hothead brute cop, Officer Bev Wife.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, LA Confidential. We've now covered, including today's LA Confidential, three Kevin Spacey movies in the past year on the Next 100 Project. How many times has he been shot and killed in those three motion pictures?
So, for those of you that can't remember which movies we've covered, they are Seven, American Beauty, and LA Confidential. And he is shot and killed in all three of those.
Right.
And in each one, really rather dramatically.
Who kills him in each one? Do you remember the actors?
Sam Shepard kills him in American Beauty. Brad Pitt kills him in Seven. And well, James Cromwell.
What? I don't think Sam Shepard or Chris Cooper would like to be compared to each other. It's Chris Cooper.
Listen.
In American Beauty.
Well, that's embarrassing. Listen, they're both older white men that I never knew who they were until they were like in their 50s. Chris Cooper killed him in American Beauty. Brad Pitt in Seven. And James Cromwell in LA Confidential.
And all three are pretty big surprises. I mean, maybe in Seven it's not that much of a surprise, but the other two movies, it's definitely a big shock. Now here's the juice! The Next 100 Project's 50th film, LA Confidential, didn't exist in time for the cutoff date to make the 1998 AFI Top 100 list, but was nominated for the 2007 edition. After Warner Brothers showed it at Cannes and TIFF earlier in 1997, LA Confidential hit screens for everybody to see on September 19th. It didn't cost that much to make and was a solid success. Bev, give him the juice, which is also known as the skinny, for L.A. Confidential.
It's 1953 in the City of Angels, when a particularly dirty precinct of the LAPD is shaken by a massacre that claims the life of a recently disgraced member of their team. Guy Pearce is Edmund Exley, who ambitiously leads the investigation with the help of Kevin Spacey's Jack Vincennes and Russell Crowe's Bud White. Their detective work reveals elaborate levels of corruption, and everyone, even our heroes, has an angle.
Or in a nutshell, I never knew the LAPD could be so violent.
What a shocking surprise.
Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 99% of critics like this movie, 107 fresh reviews, only one rotten, and 94% of audiences. It's also 102 on the IMDb's top 250. That's not a terrible ranking at all. And it was 24th at the 1997 U.S. box office. Of course, Titanic, the big Oscar winner, also was the blockbuster of that year and for many years until Avatar came around, and that became the number one movie of all time, in real money at least. About this movie, one of my favorites, not only is it required viewing, it requires multiple viewings to understand it. Bev, did you understand it this time? Did you like it? Did you love it?
It's a great movie. I love it. It's aging exceptionally. It's just as fresh and dynamic as it was 20 years ago. Great script, great direction, great cast. I think it's the best thing Curtis Hanson's ever made.
Yeah.
I take issue with a handful of scenes, but the overall effect is a rare delight. It's such a great movie.
And do you agree with what I said last week, that this should have won the Oscar in 1997 and not Titanic? Although Titanic wasn't a bad choice, and it wasn't really that surprising a choice.
Most movies that came out in 97 should have won the Oscar over Titanic, but this one especially.
Well, not the full Monty, and probably not As Good As It Gets. Although Good Will Hunting would have been a pretty decent choice, too.
I would pick Full Monty or As Good As It Gets over Titanic.
Those were the...
I would pick My Best Friend's Wedding over Titanic. Oh, I would pick...
Oh, come on.
Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery.
Lost Highway was out that year. Well, those were the five nominees I just mentioned, though. And Titanic was only really challenged by, I guess you could say, Good Will Hunting, and certainly by this one. Which has a labyrinthine plot. Shout out to Roger Ebert. That was one of his favorite words. He wrote that in reviews and always said he loved that word, labyrinthine. And a lot of dumb luck bears clues for all three guys. That's one of the things about the movie that I think you don't really dwell on too much until you've seen it multiple times like we have. Bud meeting up with both Lynn and Susan early on and discovering the whole game with Pierce Patchett. And Vincennes finding the fleur-de-lis card and getting onto the thing. Then none of this would have worked out. But then you could argue, well, there's no movie if that doesn't happen. There's also one big issue. We're getting way into the plot and saying this. But Exley fucking Lynn Bracken, Kim Basinger, we didn't say her yet, won the Oscar in the movie, actually. The Supporting Actress Oscar. That didn't work, and I didn't buy it.
That scene sticks out like a sore thumb. It's the only real failure in the film, and it is such a failure of a scene.
It's such a plot contrivance.
Even as a plot contrivance, I mean, there's plenty of plot contrivances in the movie, but even as that function, it's so poorly done. The performances come out of nowhere. They make no sense. They have zero chemistry. And I just don't even buy that he wants to do it, that he's that type of guy to begin with. It could have been written better. It could have been performed better. It almost feels like there was a scene missing or something that could have possibly explained the characters behaving this illogically.
Both of them, not just him.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to bring back something we haven't done in a little while. Reasonably good questions. I've got a few of them here. Shouldn't Bud have first asked Lynn if Exley paid for sex before he got mad and slapped her in the face and nearly killed Exley? Because she does fuck for money and he seems to accept that. So if Exley paid her, what's he got to say about that?
Well, he could say, don't accept money from this particular client because he's my arch enemy.
But I thought I was helping you.
Oh, yeah, that line is beautiful. That moment in her performance is beautiful.
The other great line that she has early on, and this is one of the other things I don't know if it makes a lot of sense either, is why is she ever with Bud? He asks her, why me, when she takes him up to her bedroom, which probably doesn't get seen by the clients. I don't know. And the way she whispers it, you buy it. Maybe because she sees something, well, she even says later, she sees something good in him.
Yeah, they have a great chemistry. They're a really probably, believable couple.
And she's probably attracted to him physically. He's a good-looking guy at that point in his career. Russell Crowe was.
And I kind of like how they don't make her line of work that big of an issue. He never gives her a hard time about it. As a matter of fact, he's like, oh, well, those idiots, all they get is Veronica Lake, but I get Lynn Bracken.
And she is breaking the law because she's taking money for sex.
And he's a cop. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem particularly ashamed of her profession. It's actually a pretty refreshing way for a hooker with a heart of gold to behave. It's not the only thing that makes her unique is that character type. I mean, she doesn't seem to love her work necessarily, but neither is she traumatized or ashamed of it. There's no maudlin backstory to explain how such a nice girl could have fallen into prostitution. She seems genuinely empowered. She's not a damsel in distress, and this is the 1950s.
She gets act a little sometimes.
Yeah, she doesn't seem down about it. She has a plan. She's doing it. What she's got to do. It's a refreshing portrayal of a sex worker.
Do you think she looks that much like Veronica Lake?
Not really, no.
She's not small enough for one thing, which isn't her fault, but Veronica Lake was 4'11". And apart from the peekaboo hairstyle, Basinger is better looking than Veronica Lake was.
Oh, I don't think so. Not to say that I don't think Kim Basinger is a beautiful woman. She totally is, but I think Veronica Lake is one of the most beautiful women that really? Ever worked in Hollywood.
I thought she was cute. Never thought she was that beautiful. Well, since we're on the Basinger kick and she won the Oscar, and is very good in the film. This was her first film in 3 years. Then she didn't do another one for another 3 years. I don't know if she was just doing the old Oscar thing. What do I do next? I don't know. I won't do anything. I don't want it to be ruined. I think it's probably, if not her very best work, it's certainly in the top three or four movies she ever did. She plays a character who's really haunted and hurt. We talked about the effectiveness of some of those scenes. And a nice touch, just like in Moonstruck, she's older than her two cop lovers. Basinger actually is literally older than Russell Crowe or Guy Pearce. And the marketing department must have realized that she was, I guess, the biggest star in the whole film, even more so than Spacey, because he was probably the second biggest star in the film, because she dominates the cover of the DVDs and Blu-rays out there. The Blu-ray that we have, she's the only thing on the cover. The DVD that I used to have had the three male actors, but they were more in the background. And she was on the front left, so obviously they thought she was the main attraction, even though her character matters, but she's not vital to the plot.
No, I agree. Her part really isn't that big, all things considered. She's more of a character motivation for Bud than she is someone there that's really that involved in the plot.
Right, so the plot, which is noir, essentially, but noir traditionally has cops in the background of their stories, And PIs are the main characters, and they're the quote-unquote good guys in our story. Think about Maltese Falcon, think about Chinatown. But there's no PIs in this movie. These are all actual cops. So calling this noir is a bit debatable. Maybe people don't really. I always thought of it as a noir film, comparing it to Chinatown and Maltese Falcon especially. But I don't think it really fits that mold. It's definitely a good mystery film, though, because there's so many layers to the storyline, and it takes all those viewings to figure it all out. Filled with remarkable corruption, and I like how they incorporate big business, represented by Pierce Patchett, who's small business when the movie gets going, but he's starting to get into bigger business, opening highways and stuff. The media, i.e. Scandal Rags, that Danny DeVito's character, Sid Hudgens, is involved in. And then the dirty cops. Everybody's into everything. In fact, Dudley Smith, the James Cromwell character here, might be the dirtiest of dirty cops we've ever seen, especially considering how important he is. It's not like he's just some dude on the force who's doing stuff and his boss is telling him not to do it. He is the boss of all these guys. He's not the ultimate boss of the LAPD, granted, but he's way up there in the pecking order.
A little overkill, in my opinion, by the time they reveal that he was trying to take over for the mafia altogether. But I want to dial it back. I want to go backwards, because I think you buried the lead. Can you explain why you don't consider this a film noir? I understand that it's not the most conventional film noir, but it was also made in 97, so it's a modern film noir. It's a modern take on it. They weren't trying to be completely nostalgic. It was trying to be a modern film while it still used the noir conventions. So why do you think it isn't?
Because noir is traditionally not cops who are the main characters, whether they be good guys or bad guys. The main characters in this movie, by a country mile, are the cops. There's no PIs doing anything. There's no Jake Gittes or Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe doing the digging. These are people who are supposed to be on the up and up, and of course most of them aren't in one way or another. Bud's not necessarily the cleanest cop in the history of the world either, although it takes a little to set him off. It is funny the way his character sees violence and reacts with violence. It's just that he gets even with the brutish guy who's beating up on the woman, and then later on he ends up kind of becoming his father briefly when he slaps Lynn around. But it is funny how he's such a Pavlov, and then of course Dudley uses that against him to try to kill Exley. He just doesn't actually go through with it. But getting back to what you're saying, I think I've said it twice now, that's why to me it's not noir. I'm not criticizing that part of it, because this is one of the great, if we're going to call it noir, it's one of the great modern films in that genre, along with Chinatown, which isn't really modern now, but we think of this genre starting in the 40s. Maltese Falcon is supposed to be the first one, and then noir was huge in the 40s and into the 50s, and I guess even into the 60s. But it wasn't such a big thing when we got into the 70s, and then people did it here and there. There's been homages and throwbacks, but no one really usually does it right, and no one usually does it quite like this one does, where it isn't even about the PIs, it's about the cops. Does that answer the question for you?
Yeah, I'm satisfied.
Okay, now a few things we just said a few minutes ago. We buried some other leads about Dudley becoming a mafia guy, essentially. Mickey Cohen is represented in the film. In fact, you've got a lot of real names used and real incidents, including the Bloody Christmas thing. That actually was an incident when the cops beat up on the Mexican dudes in the jail, and that was called Bloody Christmas by the newspapers. And Mickey Cohen, of course, is a real person. He was the Saddam Hussein of LA, I think, before he went to jail, because he kept out a lot of other thugs. Was he a bad dude? Yeah. But at least he was keeping out worse dudes. And had it not been for Dudley's scheme, they would have taken over in L.A. and made it more dangerous for people. I'm not excusing this guy, because like I said, he's an incredibly dirty cop. But that's one thing that was happening, is Mickey Cohen was the one guy they had to worry about, instead of a lot of guys they had to worry about. As for Dudley's corruption, one thing that he has nothing to do with that we ever at least hear about, maybe Pierce would have gotten into this scheme if he wasn't killed. Of course, one of the many characters in this movie that are killed is Pierce Patchett. Whenever they're at the Victory Motel, you see oil derricks pumping in the background, which suggests more corruption. Not that the oil business has to be corrupt, but so often it has been corrupt. It's never commented on, but you see them out there all the time, and that's one of the things that helped America and so many other countries become corrupted too, by having this resource that everybody needs, and of course that's going to get corrupted.
It's also a very California thing, and this movie really is so much about L.A. L.A. is, mm-hmm. I know it's a cliche way to put it, but the main character of the film is the city. And part of that is that, yeah, when you drive out, there's oil derricks out there.
Out there, the Victory Motel. We also have the Night Owl. We're working in broad stereotypes here with these names. But mostly they use real locations in L.A., and a lot of them. They went to a lot of different places to shoot this movie. I guess the Victory Motel is one of the few sets they made, probably because they shot it up so much. They couldn't really even take a real hotel and say, hey, we're going to destroy this place. They actually did destroy that set they created out there. And did you notice that in the Victory Motel, there never seems to be anybody there, especially when there's cop business going on, but there never seems to be anybody there at all other than the cops and the people that they're dealing with. We go to that motel probably three or four different times.
But isn't it deserted?
I guess that's the argument, isn't it? Because no one else ever seems to be there.
Yeah, I don't think it's in business. How could they nail a chair to the floor? All the things they do in that room.
Well, because cops get away with things because they're
caught. And look at the room when they actually go and have the shootout. There's like a bare mattress on the floor. It seems to me it's been abandoned.
Well, maybe you're right then. You ruined my little theory then. I just said Night Owl. Of course, that's the diner where the massacre takes place. I love the touch that the Night Owl case has an awful sidebar, and the black guys, the Negroes, that are supposed to have been the ones that killed all those people in that diner, aren't responsible for that. What they are responsible for is something that's, well, maybe not worse, because killing people is, I guess, the worst thing you could ever do. But what they are doing is raping a poor woman. And when Bud White breaks the chair with his bare hands, they really sell that Russell Crowe is this big brute, even though he's not that much bigger than me. He's just shy of 6 feet tall, which is, I guess, 4 inches on me. But still, he's not that much bigger than a regular-looking dude like me. In the book, I guess he was supposed to be this huge, monstrous brute, just like Jack Reacher, who's also not played by a very big actor. But Russell Crowe sells it that he's this monster, and when he breaks that chair in half, I always buy that he could do that, even though it seems illogical that anyone could actually do that.
It's like Russell Crowe's defining feature, that he has this menace about him. He's just such an intimidating guy by his very nature. They cast him because they saw him in Romper Stomper, mm-hmm. which not a lot of people have seen, but it was a big Australian film that he was the star of, and he played a neo-Nazi. Good movie if you ever want to check it out. But he was an unknown. It's hard to believe that this is the movie that made both him and Guy Pearce Hollywood stars. Nobody knew who they were. Curtis Hanson wanted it that way because he thought it was important to cast people that no one had any impression of, so that he could really make the audience dislike these characters before he made the audience like them, which he does very effectively. But Russell Crowe kind of went on from Romper Stomper in this movie to make a career out of being the tough guy.
He had a great run from 97, including this movie, obviously, to 2003, where he made good movie after good movie. I think he should have played more cops, because he's a very believable cop in this film. And in the movie, this character has nothing but being a cop. Well, I mean, when he meets Lynn, that changes, I guess, but he gets kicked off the force briefly, and then Dudley wants him to be his muscle, so he puts him back on the force. And when Dudley offers his gun and badge back, when Bud reaches for it, it's with fervor. I gotta have it right now. I can't wait till the end of this conversation. I gotta have that stuff in my possession instantly. Because that's all he has, at least at that point, before he meets Lynn.
Like, one of the main driving themes of the movie is fleur-de-lis, whatever you desire. What does each person desire? What motivates them? And for most people, it's simple things like money, comfort, and ease of life. But then you have a character like Bud White, who's just motivated to avenge his mother's death and to get back at every man that ever beat his wife. For Exley, his motivation is just this pure ambition. He doesn't want people to like him. He doesn't want to make money. He just wants to do better than his father as a cop. And in a way, perhaps to solve his father's murder. And that's what keeps the integrity. He doesn't want people to get away with things. But even more than integrity, because he'll lie to get what he wants, is his ambition. And then Vincent, who is motivated by money, was motivated more than anything by fame, that his attachment to the crime show. The movie like really likes to explore how each and every one of us has a price.
Actually, he's a glory hound and a snitch, but he's a goddamn good cop.
Hell yeah.
And he generally does the right thing. Doesn't always do the right thing, but he generally does.
There's a great moment, I think my favorite scene in the movie, and there's a lot of great scenes to choose from, when he follows the lead and goes to get the Negroes, God, I hate that word, goes and gets the black suspects who have quote-unquote escaped prison. They pull a gun on him, his life is in danger, and he has to go after them and shoot them. He's scared for his own life, and he's motivated to just get the bad guy. And one guy gets away from him, gets into the elevator, and just as that door is closing at the last second, he can get his rifle in there, he pulls the trigger. And when the elevator door opens, we don't see what he sees.
Yeah.
We see his face. Even though we later learn he killed his target and everything was fine, he knows he did something wrong. He knows that there could have been anybody else in that elevator, and he pulled the trigger anyways. He knows that he got caught up in the violence and in all the things he promised himself he would never do. You know, in a scene earlier, we see Bud White straight up commit murder to a man with no pants on and is not armed. He doesn't wait for him to pull a gun or anything. He just pulls the trigger and kills him right there in what is cold blood. That is murder, what he commits. Yeah. But Exley's better than that, except he's not.
He
tried to be, but when he's scared, when the adrenaline is going, he pulled the trigger in a completely inappropriate situation, and we get to really look at his face as he's processing this information, processing the fact that he just killed two people, and that he's survived this act of violence himself. But also processing the fact that he did something really bad. that he won't get in trouble for.
And I love the touch, too, that those guys were let out of jail, obviously by the cops they're left behind, when Bud and Dudley and everyone went to try to find the rapists, because that was the surprise touch. No one knew that's what these black guys were supposedly guilty of. First, we see the underling cops trying to set up these guys.
Another stroke of luck. Like,
right, yeah. Exactly. When Vincenzo and Exley catch those guys doing that. I love the way that that one cop has the look on his face twice. When they're caught by Exley and Vincenzo, now what do? Because they were planting the gun, so these guys would have gone to jail. Then those guys are let out of jail. And he's the one that gets shot when Exley goes with him. And the same deal is all about how we're supposed to go to kill these guys. This isn't to get them back. We got to blow them away. But Exley's there, too. That's messing with it yet again. So there's all kinds of layers just to the Night Owl case that involves black guys who are raping a girl, which had nothing to do with the main plot. I think I got that basically the first time I saw the movie, but it's definitely one of the more confusing things until you see it multiple times.
Oh, the first time I watched the movie, the plot just washed over me. I'm sure at the end when it's revealed that Dudley was a bad guy all along, I was just like, what's happening? Well, those two seem to be friends now. That's nice. But it didn't matter. Like, the film gets away with this because the character development is the drive, and it's really beautifully wrought. Exley, Vincennes, and White all have great arcs and amazing performances. So we may be confused at the end why everybody got to the hotel shootout, but we're still really deeply invested in our characters, and you can just let the stuff slide and go with it and enjoy it.
Well, when Dudley does turn, played so well by James Cromwell, by the way, oh boyo, he was coming off nice guy roles in Babe and Star Trek First Contact, so of course it was a big surprise that he would end up being such a brutal bad guy.
But good casting. Yeah. Everybody saw Babe, and he is the most lovable, sweetest, trustworthy man in that movie.
And he's likable in Star Trek First Contact. He ends up being the reason why First Contact is even made. But when Dudley does turn on Vincennes, here's a reasonably good question. Does Dudley always keep a gun in the pocket of his bathrobe? Or was it because he knew that Vincennes was coming over and knew that he might have to kill him?
I wonder if you watch it closely, if you see a point where he would have had an opportunity to arm himself.
Well, it's not sitting on the stove, which is where he's standing when he turns and fires and kills him.
That is a reasonably good question.
Oh, you're actually taking this seriously. It's supposed to be a bit of a wisecrack, because it's a movie contrived. Of course he doesn't need to have a gun with him until it matters in this moment.
The movie's full of clever details. It's one of those movies where the closer attention you pay, the more you notice how much attention was paid to the film.
Well, you
film.
Can't ask reasonably good questions until you've seen a movie many times. Yeah, yeah, break down the plot. But staying on the Dudley questions thing, did he have some backup cops handy to replace the multitude of dead ones? If his plan had worked out, a lot of cops have died in the past few days and weeks. Where are they going to get backups from?
Initially, in the Victory Hotel scene at the end, I had assumed that it was all the other dirty cops who were shooting out. And then one of the reviews I read pointed out that, no, it was Hitman. He was running the mob at this point, he would have had hitmen. So, because as they're shooting in the shootout, these people they're shooting at are their co-workers that they've known for years. And I'm like thinking, I've worked at the same place for 10 years. What if my producer turned on me? And
if they were firing a gun at you, you'd fire back.
I guess so, but I would probably have a harder time coping with it than those two seem to. And it makes more sense to think, oh no, they were mobsters that were working for Dudley.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, but still, a lot of cops die in the course of this movie.
Oh, yes.
Under his command. And in the storyline, as the years went on, long before a lot of cops died, based on what he was doing. It's one thing for a cop to die in the line of duty, but they died because he was a dirty cop for many years before, including, as we discussed during the film, the Rollo Tomasi thing, the one who supposedly killed Exley's father. He doesn't know who the person was. He gave him that name, and that's the last line that Spacey says before he dies. That great death scene that Spacey has. You seem so matter-of-fact about this, but I actually just put together that when Exley describes the whole thing to Vincennes, it sounds like Dudley's probably the one who killed his dad.
Or if not Dudley, then some corrupt cop. Exley's father, probably like Exley, you kind of assume that he's trying to follow his father's footsteps. And if he was a good cop, then there's a really good chance that it wasn't just some rando purse snatcher that took him out. It could have very easily been a cop in an assassination.
And one of the influences from the film is that a band actually named a song, what's that band? The Sheepdogs, called one of their songs Rollo Tomasi.
Oh, really?
Bud White is immortal. No amount of bullets can kill this guy.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't even seem like he's that bad off at the end of the film.
There's a few really far-fetched things that happen. Bud White surviving a shot to the face among all the other bullets that he takes. I get that he's kind of busted up by the end, but it was the 50s. I don't know what medical technology was at then, but apparently it was far ahead of where we are now that this man could survive that many gunshot wounds. I also find it hard to believe that Captain Dudley Smith was the leader of the Mafia.
I can buy that one.
I believe that he'd be corrupt, that he'd be working for a mafia boss, that he would be the boss himself. A little far-fetched. Another thing, these two totally honest cops, well, especially Exley, take the district attorney, rough him up, and hang him out of a window.
And the secretary never even comes to the room and says, can I get somebody some coffee or maybe save my boss?
They get away with it. Yeah. It's the solution to the problem, to getting what they want, is to take their boss's boss's boss, almost kill him, and then be like, that was easy. And Exley, in the end, is commended. He gets medals. He gets promotions.
He's dirty, too, but you're right. Just when you go by the logic of it, doesn't really hold up, does it? All right, well, one more reasonably good question. We'll get off that kick. When Bud finds Buzz Meeks' corpse under that woman's house, does he never report that? He gives her the money, compliments of the LAPD, but there is a dead body under there.
Well, at this point, he's caught on that something corrupt is going on, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be that he just doesn't want the LAPD to know what he's up to.
It could be.
And that he's investigating
this. And as we said, he's not exactly the cleanest cop either. He's willing to shoot a guy in the back to see justice is done. And that's a nice touch at the end of the film. The guy who needs glasses can see Dudley very clearly in the climax, that being Exley. And the guy, Exley, who wouldn't shoot a guilty man in the back when he's asked to, he says more than once, I wouldn't do that. He's finally able to. You talk about cold-blooded murder, he cold-bloodedly murders Dudley Smith. One of the more famous scenes in The French Connection, one of the poster shots, in fact, where Gene Hackman says, stop, halt, and shoots the French guy in the back when he's getting off the subway train because Hackman has to get his man. He's willing to do whatever it takes, including something that cops are never supposed to do, which is shoot a man from behind.
And maybe that's another way that that scene where he catches the black suspects makes it more important. They were bad guys. They were doing a bad thing. He saw for himself what they did to that girl, and they pulled guns on him. And maybe there's a part of him that's like, I took a risk. It paid off. It's better that he's dead. It's better that he didn't get away. Maybe that's part of what made him able to cross that line and kill Smith. Smith, who was so arrogant. His performance, let's praise James Cromwell's performance here, because he has this great natural charm. He's a charismatic sociopath. He clearly feels no ways about anything he's doing. He has no remorse about any of the people he kills. He kills Vincent in cold blood and doesn't seem to blink an eye about it. But he also has this warm dad-like appeal. He has all these little Irish sayings calling people boyo. There's something about him that's just so inviting. And it's such a great, nuanced performance. Just to go backwards a little bit, you were talking about the body underneath the house. Another great performance is the victim's mother, who's such a weirdo. And I love the touch that is so often in crime shows, crime movies, they interrogate a witness, and they get the exact answer that they need, and then they turn around, and it's just like a plot device. She gives them wrong answers, she's belligerent. It kind of plays with that cop show format of using it as a throwaway scene, and she becomes a more interesting, wacky character for
it. And she seems to know that there's a dead body under there.
Yeah.
A human body, not just some...
Is it the rats?
Yeah. What about Pierce Patchett's scheme where he cuts up women to look like movie stars? That feels like that must have happened in reality, or at least should have happened in reality. It's shitty. But then again, like Lynn says, we get to act a little. They get paid all right. She has a nice house.
Oh, yeah,
she If you're does. Willing to be a whore, not a bad gig to have, actually.
It's a job. And a lot of sex workers have been advocating to stop treating it like it's just this shame, crime. It's a job. They're sex workers. Porn stars get plastic surgery all the time. Maybe not to look like movie stars, but I don't see why it would be so unusual back then. And I kind of actually dislike the line when Bud White first meets her and he calls her a whore like 3 times in the first 5. She's like, you're the first guy in forever that hasn't called me Veronica Lake inside 5 minutes. No, but he called you a whore over and over. I don't know. Is that what makes him different? That's kind of weird. But when she says, oh, I was born looking like this. They just colored my hair. Does that really make you different from those other girls that you were just lucky to be Veronica Lake? But that's the moment that we're supposed to be like, oh, she's different. She didn't get plastic surgery. Well, she's still a prostitute. She's still working for this man who's clearly a really bad guy. She doesn't seem to have a problem with it. Oh, but she didn't have plastic surgery. That's where we draw the line. I always found that line weird.
Yeah. Pierce Patchett wants to be Noah Cross from Chinatown. He wants to be the guy who's got his hands in everything and so rich and so powerful. But he doesn't get that far because they kill him before he can get that far. But staying with the whole idea of the cut-up whores, of course, that leads to one of the best laughs in the whole film, where Exley calls Lana Turner, the real Lana Turner, a whore, and then Johnny Stampanato is threatening to get mad at him. But the way that he and Spacey play that, a whore cut-up to look like Lana Turner, still a whore, she is Lana Turner. When Spacey says that from behind, great laugh. The movie's not that funny, but that's a really funny scene.
Those two build up a camaraderie. Exley is just an unlikable guy. Right off the bat, first of all, he's like a killjoy, rule-following little sergeant that clearly doesn't want to have fun with anybody. He turns on his colleagues immediately. Of course, they did something
very bad. I love that he is criticized for being too honest and too good at the job, and usually by shitty cops, not Bud and Jack. But a lot of those other guys, including Stenslin, are awful cops.
Oh my god, they're so bad. But just in case you were on his side at all, there is the scene after Stenslin has been fired, and he's telling Bud White about it, and he's really rather smug. Oh, I got your partner fired. What do you think of that? He's kind of an asshole about it. Oh no, it's after Stenslin's dead in the Night Owl Massacre. So your partner's dead.
No. I know what you're talking about. I read that scene way differently. He says something about how it's a tougher sentence than going to prison to get killed like that. I don't think he's trying to play that smug, because Bud doesn't react. Bud reacts so easily and so often, especially to Exley in the whole movie, and he doesn't react badly to that when his blood is up, boyo. I think that Bud's actually recognizing that Exley's saying, I may not have liked the guy much, but what a shitty way to have to go out a few days after he is starting his retirement. He's killed in some diner.
And it should be such a tired trope that you have White and Exley, who are two cops that grow to love each other when they're, like, working the same case and learn to respect each other. It's a pretty tired thing. But this movie does it so convincingly and so sincerely. The characters are so well drawn, and the writing's so good, their performances are so good, that by the end, when they are working together and they're in that hotel, they seem to do all these things without even needing to talk about it. They have their training, mm-hmm. and they're putting the mattress up on the window, yeah. and fighting together, and they have
the camaraderie. Earlier at Patrick's house, throwing the keys to each other.
Yes, all that yes! Too. I found it so satisfying. I love it. The movie just takes you there so adeptly. That's really what it does better than anything else.
And with Spacey, I guess his connection is the scene after the Lana Turner laugh scene, where they go to the car and Vincennes is still laughing at him, and then actually can laugh at himself. Yeah. That's when they connect.
Yes, Vincennes is a far easier guy to get along with. Mm. So their relationship, it's not as challenging for them to find one another. But you're so happy for Exley to just have found a friend, somebody yeah. who's on his side.
Yeah.
And Vincennes has that great turnaround where he changes his mind about the type of cop he wants to be because he sees that actor. He's another Australian.
Simon Baker, yeah.
Yeah, Simon Baker, yeah. He's the star of The Mentalist. You would never recognize him. He's so young. Mm-hmm. He gets taken advantage of by Danny DeVito. We've barely talked about him, but he's the journalist who runs the gossip rag. And he's taking advantage of this young actor. And Vincennes finally feels conflicted about this kid having his life ruined.
And then his life ended.
And then his life
more importantly.
Ended. Okay, who killed him?
It may have been Ellis Lowe, the DA, who gets hung out the window. It may have been just one of his people. But I think it's just so he'll keep his mouth shut. That's why a lot of people get killed in this movie, so they'll keep their mouth shut.
I was the one thing in the movie, no matter how many times I see it, I'm always like, but why is he dead? What happened?
Maybe he said or did the wrong thing and Ellis had a knife and just said, fuck you, I'm the DA, I'm going to cut your damn throat.
So he's a murderer too?
I don't know, that's not clear, I'm just speculating.
There's not a lot of good people in this movie. Like, straightforwardly good people. There are ethical people, but whether they're good or not is certainly
nobody is truly good in this movie.
No.
Everyone's got some kind of character flaw. In this giant cast with about 80 speaking parts, plenty of unusual casting choices. We talked about that. Noam was a true headliner at the time. Basinger and Spacey were the closest things to that. Spacey had won the Oscar for Usual Suspects, so he was a star-ish. But I wouldn't say he was a headliner. I mean, Nicholson won the Oscar that same year, in 1997, for As Good As It Gets. One of the biggest stars ever. Not to compare Spacey to him, but Nicholson's the top of the mountain. Spacey's somewhere in the middle of a mountain at that point, even after being an Oscar winner. And interestingly, Spacey and Crowe won Oscars in 1999 and 2000 for American Beauty and Gladiator, so back-to-back years. And I wonder if those were make-good awards, because nobody in this cast was nominated for an Oscar except for Basinger, and a lot of people thought that was a bad nomination and a bad win. I don't think it was a bad nomination. Maybe she shouldn't have won, but the guys were overlooked. Maybe because you couldn't nominate them all. We talked about how good Cromwell was. Spacey, Crowe, Pierce, DeVito's terrific in the film, too. How do you nominate all these great male actors? Okay, fuck it, let's go with the woman. And basically the only woman in the movie who matters all that much, apart from the mother and Susan Leffers, has a few scenes, but basically it's just her.
The Academy's always reluctant to award people in their first big role. As far as Spacey goes, I think at that point, it wasn't just L.A. Confidential that he was great in, so it's possible the Academy had seen him, like you say, make good. I mean, I loved him in American Beauty.
I do too. Oh, it's a great
So I'm like, I think he deserved it just for American Beauty, but he also deserved it for Seven for L.A. Confidential. As for Russell Crowe, he's probably someone that history will look back on and go, I mean, he's a good actor and he has a great screen presence, but is he one of the greats? I don't know. I mean, people don't really talk about Gladiator all that much anymore. Or if they do, they're probably more apt to talk about Joaquin Phoenix's performance than his.
Mm. Spacey was playing the character Dean Martin-esque, even said about how that's what Curtis Hanson suggested, give it the old ring-a-ding. Which of the three main actors do you think is the best, if we have to grade them? And we are doing Oscar month, and that's all about ranking and voting for people. So Spacey, Crow, and Pierce, which one do you think is the best of the three?
Well, it seems pretty obvious that Spacey is the easy choice. I had really high hopes for Guy Pierce between this and Memento and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I mean, you look at his performance in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and then in L.A. Confidential. I remember when somebody told me those were the same guy, I didn't believe them, and I had to look it up. He is a real chameleon in that way. But his career kind of fizzled out. He's done a few good things, but it's been pretty disappointing. Whereas Spacey, I mean, come on, it never ends. He just keeps giving us one great character after another.
Including now House of Cards.
Oh, yeah. I just love Kevin Spacey. He can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned.
Danny DeVito, the little dynamo. He was brilliant in Get Shorty. He's so funny. I think he steals the whole film from everybody else, and that's a good cast in general. He was fun in Cuckoo's Nest, which we covered on the Top and Under Project way back when. And the Hush Hush Scandal rag that he runs, the National Enquirer-esque magazine, was actually based on a magazine called Confidential, which was in the 50s. So that's another thing that's based on reality. Just like they mentioned the Robert Mitchum pot bust, which actually happened. And then Davis Strathairn, who does play Pierce Patchett, very smooth. Not a big role, but a good performance in the small role. John Sayles, veteran, worked with him a ton of times. And of course, in Good Night and Good Luck, where he maybe could have won the Oscar himself in 2005, but did not. As for the director, Curtis Hanson, we didn't talk about him that much because this is not an auteuristic kind of film. He lets the actors and the scenery set the scene for him and then let it play out. And of course, a great screenplay that he helped co-write with Brian Helgeland. He paid tremendous attention to detail, but the quote was he was going to keep that in the background. Sort of like the New York and Royal Tenenbaums, where you know they're in New York, but it's not clearly obvious.
And again, you know it's 1953, but it's not clearly obvious. They don't keep trying to remind you of it, have long, beautiful porno shots of 50s cars or anything. You just kind of let them exist in the background so that you always feel like you're there, but there was a real verisimilitude to it.
And when Spacey walks out the Frolic Room at one point, you see The Bad and the Beautiful on the movie marquee right beside the Frolic Room, and that movie was released in very late 1952, so it would have been playing more so in 1953. And that's a movie maybe we should cover this year because it is an anniversary. It's the 65th anniversary, am I thinking that right? Yeah, I think so, 65.
Also one of your favorites.
One of my favorites. It's terrific, and Lana Turner is in it. Hanson had done The River Wild before this, Wonder Boys after it. I love Wonder Boys, one of Michael Douglas's best ever performances. And then a few years after that, did 8 Mile with Kim Basinger. Mm-hmm. And that was a big success, too. He's had an interesting career, but you said earlier, nothing is even close to as good as that. Well, Wonder Boys I love a lot, but it's not the same kind of movie, so I don't want to put them on the same pedestal. I probably enjoyed Wonder Boys more. I've seen that so many times. I saw that twice in the theater. I don't go to the theater to see movies twice very often, but I love that one.
I think he's a very competent director. I think he knows how to make a really good film, and he avoids a lot of the pitfalls and mistakes that Hollywood movies just seem to make over and over again. But yeah, L.A. Confidential is where the lightning was in the bottle for him.
He and Helgeland worked on this for a very long time. Helgeland was writing drafts for free. He wanted to do Payback, which I loved, but not the version that's his version. The one that Mel Gibson and some other people recut on him. Yeah, another example of the one was in the theater is the better one. It's funnier. I've seen whatever they call it, the real cut or something that Helgeland actually released, and it's not as good a movie. Sorry, Brian, but the one that Mel took away from you was better. Helgeland also wrote Mystic River, and that may be one of his more big credits, but I was looking through what else he has worked on in recent years. He's a very good writer. He doesn't have a lot of great screenplays on his credit, or great movies at least to his credit, but quite a few good ones. He's been around for quite a long time. And Hanson and Helgeland based it on James Ellroy's 1990 novel, which was the third book of four in a series that Ellroy worked on. And of course, he's the big crime guy from
the L.A. series.
Then. Right, yeah. And the producers were Hanson himself, Arnon Milchan, who was a producer on 12 Years a Slave a few years ago. He's been involved in some good movies over the years. And I guess the guy that deserves a lot of credit for getting this going at all is Michael G. Nathanson. They all combined to make a 2.35:1 print, which was pretty solid on the Blu-ray that we watched. I actually tried watching it in black and white one time. I just turned all the color down to try to get the 1940s noir feel. And because it wasn't shot that way, it didn't really work. It didn't look bad. It just didn't look right. Cinematographer was Dante Spinotti, who worked on Heat and The Insider, so obviously he's a Michael Mann guy. And the movie looks great. Those movies look great. The editor, Peter Hoeneß, he worked on Fast and the Furious from 2001 and The Chamber of Secrets, the Harry Potter movie, the second one. But how about the music? The legendary Jerry Goldsmith, one of his great scores of all time. This was his second-to-last Oscar nomination ever. I think he had 18 or something in his whole career. Only ever won for The Omen, which we covered last fall. And I had mentioned to you when it was coming up at the very end, my favorite part of the whole music was the last bit before the credits roll. That Anyway, I'm not doing justice the way it plays out, but it's a great score.
I also really like their use of diegetic music, like Wheel of Fortune song.
I keep hearing in my head the last few days when I was preparing for the podcast, Burning, turning.
It's the wheel of fortune that turns and turns. So at the time, everything's going well for all of our characters, but the song is reminding us that...
Oh, is it Yearning is one of the lyrics?
Oh, right? Yeah, maybe. Okay. I'm singing and we it know that things are going to go bad for them again, just because Bud's in love and Exley's doing well in his career. Just you wait. That's what the song is saying.
Yeah. What about the editing? Because it's a long movie and it's very dense, and of course, it lost to Titanic. Every nomination this movie had that didn't win was a loss to Titanic, including the editing.
I thought the editing was wonderful. First of all, it wasn't over 3 hours long like Titanic was. But all things considered, they had a really hard job. The pacing's phenomenal. Every scene flows so well. The tone is perfectly kept with the exception of that one terrible scene. So I think they did a great job.
Yeah, where Exley's almost snorting through his nose in his lust for Lynn Bracken, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's what people do when they're in lust, is they snort through their nose. They look like they can't stand each other in that scene. Oh my god, and then they start making out. I'm like, it makes no sense. Anyways.
But it's one of the many setups in the whole film, because, of course, Sid is shooting them with his camera. That's why it's all set up that way. Okay, I mentioned some of the influence. This movie is a cousin to Chinatown, and even somewhat Who Framed Roger Rabbit, with some of the corrupt business dealings behind the scenes. About a highway that was in there. And if it's a cousin to Chinatown, that was a cousin to Maltese Falcon, so we got to go back to that one, way back when, the supposed first ever noir film. And the other influence is a failed pilot, and it would have starred Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Vincennes, and Melissa George, as Lynn Bracken. But obviously it didn't get picked up. I don't know why. Maybe they didn't like the fact that they couldn't swear and use blood and stuff. Hey, I said in Chicago last week that movie should have had blood and maybe some more boobs. Well, they didn't have any boobs, I guess, but been an R-rated movie, to be honest, to its core, but they wanted to make more money, so they made it PG-13. Well, L.A. Confidential was rated R, earned its R. There's a lot of blood in this film, especially in the climax.
It's an incredibly violent movie, and I don't think we've really given it credit yet for the adeptness of the action.
Oh, yeah.
It's not really over-dramatized. It's played to be very realistic, but also incredibly tense. That scene in the Victory Motel, the shootout, I was at the edge of my seat the whole time, but it also feels like real violence. It happens out of nowhere, it happens really quickly, and it's ugly and it's bloody, like you said.
Just thought of something else that may be a bit of a cheat on the movie's part. All these white cops, and none of them call the black guys the N-word. It's all Negro, if anything at all. I never once heard the N-I N-word.
Yeah, if they were gonna be honest, but maybe it was like, we've already made the audiences hate the characters enough. We don't need to make them racist on top of it. Even though, of course, they're racist. I think they throw some slander around when they talk about the Mexicans that are in jail, the Bloody Christmas thing. But they didn't cross that line when it came to the black guys. They pulled that particular punch.
Yeah. Okay, the awards and list section. The movie was nominated for a lot of things. It didn't win, including a lot of Oscars. But it did win for Kim Basinger's supporting actress and for the Hanson and Helgeland screenplay. The failed nominations, 7 of them. Best Picture, Best Director for Hanson, the editing, the cinematography, the sets, the sound, and Jerry Goldsmith's music, all of those lost to Titanic. L.A. Confidential made the National Film Registry in 2015, along with Shawshank Redemption, Ghostbusters, the original, and the 1931 Dracula. Interesting group from the 25 that made the registry in 2015. So it will be preserved by Congress as long as Congress exists, and as long as the current president doesn't destroy that and the entire country and the entire world. The movie was nominated for the Top 100 Thrills, the Top 100 Genres in the Mystery category, and the Top 25 Music Scores. And, of course, I'm biased, but I think it could have made all three of those lists, especially the genres, because Hitchcock didn't need to have 4 of the 10. But I've said that before. All right, well, last thoughts on L.A. Confidential, the non-Oscar winner in Oscar month. It's the first time we've done this in the 2 years where we didn't have an actual Oscar winner. But again, I'll say it. It should have been.
I think a lot of people agree with this. It made a lot of critics number one of 97 lists. I firmly believe every movie, even movies made before or after 97, should have beat Titanic for the Oscar for Best Picture. But L.A. Confidential, I believe, more than most, it is at least in like top 3 movies of 97. If you haven't seen it in a while, see it again. It really rewards repeat viewings. And you'll never believe that Russell Crowe was ever that young.
It's one of the great modern movies, so well acted, so well written, so dense, and it does reward multiple viewings because we were discussing through the film about, oh, that's that thing, and that leads to that thing. And maybe one day we'll figure out the whole Simon Baker twist on who killed him and why. All right, great film. So, on the next edition of the Next 100 Project, we'll spend a while gabbing about the 2016 Academy Awards. It's our second annual Oscars preview show. I don't have any trivia for this one because I didn't think of anything good, so why don't we just do this? You tell us, listeners, what you think will win Best Picture in 2016. Well, okay, 2017, but from 2016. And what you think should win, because usually those are not the same thing for most people. I say Moonlight should follow Spotlight. That was the winner last year. And next year we can have Sunlight, followed in 2019 by Trump Light, and finally, Impeachment Light.
Or Nuclear Fallout
Light. Actually, let's have the Impeachment Light a little sooner than 2020, because that'll be the year that he has to run again anyway, if he is still president.
All right, so we look forward to hearing from you. If you would like to reach us, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We have covered, Ryan...
Not yet, almost 200
movies. Including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and 07 lists of the best Hollywood movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, and while you're there, rate us, review us. We do this for popularity and no other reason. And once more, before we go, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Rolo Tomasi.
And cut.